least this is the way that I see it, that the son is the one that we're meant to be sympathizing with. The Turner was a lover of light and a lover of beauty. You've got to believe that his sympathy was with the beauty of the sun and not the ugliness of the steam.
Welcome to Faith and Culture, a production of the Augustine Institute. Every week, we explore the glory of the Catholic faith and the beauty of Catholic culture. And now, here's the host of Faith and Culture, Joseph Pierce.
Welcome to the Faith and Culture podcast. My name is Jared Stout, and I am the guest host today for our second of two conversations on painting. I'm interviewing your normal host, Joseph Pierce, whom I believe needs no introduction.
Well, hopefully not. Hopefully not.
Well, in our first conversation, we were looking at late medieval and Renaissance and Baroque paintings. But today, we are moving into the 19th and 20th century. We're not leaving the Middle Ages behind completely. There's still going to be some engagement there. But Joseph, why don't you tell us about our first painting?
Yeah, so basically, you know, this two-part tour of some of the masterpieces of Western art. And the first of all, let me just remind you, by the way, you probably get more out of this podcast if you get ready to go into Google Images, put a search in for the artist as we introduce each painting. So you can be looking at the painting at the same time that we're looking at the painting and discussing it. But yes, in the first of the podcast, we're really focusing on some of your favorite paintings. You clearly have a penchant for the medieval and Renaissance painting. And clearly, when we asked each other, these podcasts sprung from a conversation, a chat we had probably over a beer, when we were talking about, you know, what's our respective favorite works of art. And what I didn't realize, what at least I hadn't thought about, was that most of my actual favorite works of art are actually relatively modern, which is true of most of my favorite works of literature. So I'm a rather paradoxical traditionalist who likes modern art.
I'll try not to hold that against you.
So yes, the first painting we want to discuss is actually a painting by one of my favorite artists, and that's Turner, the English painter Turner. And this is his, arguably his most famous painting. It's called The Fighting Temeraire. So be Googling that now, and you will see as you get the painting up that it's one of the many things that I love about Turner, as you will see from this, is he's a proto-impressionist. So you normally think about the impressionist movement, you think about France, but Turner actually predates the French impressionists and was doing all sorts of things with light. His famous last words were, at least allegedly, "The sun is God." Probably not what you want, the last thing you want to confess before you die. But the point, what he was saying is, obviously he had this great fascination for light. And some of his late paintings, seascapes, are really just shades of grey. I mean, they're almost, foreshadowings, not just of impressionism, but of abstract expressionism. It's just the play of colour. But this is an earlier painting, which is not quite that extreme. So we can see what's going on here. So, you know, we have this tugboat, and it's tugging in a fighting temeraire, so a ship that had been a man of war, I'm guessing, though I haven't bothered to check, that it, from the Napoleonic Wars, because that would be the time when Turner's painting, which would be sort of a couple of decades after the Napoleonic Wars, so decommissioning this British warship. But we have this fascination, first of all, seascapes. Turner's known for seascapes. And we also have this sunset. So we have the sun, the light of the sun on the sky, the light of the sun on the sea. And I suppose it's really, the reason I like it is because it just does show a real delight in the beauty of the cosmos, even if Turner perhaps wouldn't put it in purely Christian terms. It's that understanding of anthropos, you know, where you know, as St. Thomas Aquinas teaches us, that through humility our eyes are open to wonder, and it's wonder that leads to contemplation and the dilation of the soul into the fullness of reality. And I think that's what we're seeing here. We are seeing this dilatatio, the opening up of the mind and the heart and the soul into the fullness of the beauty of God's creation. I think that's why I love this painting.
And, you know, you talk about delight, and Turner certainly can delight us, but he can also, I think, terrorize us as well. Some of these seascapes, right? You know, you don't want to be anywhere near them.
Right.
And you see this power of nature, this raw power. He also engaged the slave trade, you know, in one of his most famous paintings, right? To see the terror that we can inflict upon one another, in that case, through the sea, right, with slaves drowning in the sea.
Yes.
In this case, I think you also see, you know, the power of the emerging industrialism, right? You have this little tugboat powered by steam who's able to pull this much larger ship, right?
That's an extremely good observation, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's a little bit out of proportion, right? You know, you see the beauty of this larger sea ship. But, you know, now this being decommissioned, it's just being pulled along.
It's
you know,
this
black
past.
Smoke.
So the sail ship's a thing of the past.
That's
and,
right.
Know, steam power. That's true. And one of his other great poems, I always forget the exact name of it now, but it's basically steam, speed, and something or other. And basically it's
rail, or is it?
No. It just shows a steam train going over a bridge, and it's all about speed and power. Mm-hmm. But same thing again, this is ultra, you know, we in the 20th century we have the futurist movement in art, right? But this is very futurist, because he's really saying that we have this new industrialism coming along, mm-hmm. and it has all this power, and it's sort of, if you like, taking over from the old things. And mm-hmm. You know, I do actually see him in some senses, you know, just visually, he reminds me of what orally Wagner reminds me. It's a lot of power, a lot of passion, a lot mm-hmm. of movement. And I do think that sort of in terms of visual art, he's very similar to what Wagner was doing just a little bit later in the 19th century.
And of course, the movement here is the setting sun, right? The sun is about to go down just as the ship sees its last.
Right, so the symbolism, know. Yeah, the death of sail, the birth of steam, the sun's going down on older things. Yeah, but I like to think, at least this is the way that I see it, that the sun is the one that we're meant to be sympathizing with. The beauty of the sun, mm-hmm. the beauty of the sunset, that glorious dilation of the light over the clouds above the sea, that's where the beauty is. And so there's a contrast between the two. But as Turner, as Turner was a lover of light and a lover of beauty, you've got to believe that his sympathy was with the beauty of the sun and not the ugliness of the steam.
And the sun won't fail us. And in that sense,
right.
Maybe it is an image of God. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And the sun will rise again, and steam has already passed away, right?
So. Now, sun plays significantly into our second painting as well. Can you explain that for us?
Yes, probably my favorite of all the Impressionist paintings is Rouen Cathedral in Full Sunlight by Monet. Now, Monet did a whole series of paintings of just the facade of Rouen Cathedral in various stages of light, times of day, and cloud. And this is in full sunlight. And you'd have gathered from the first painting I chose that I like the sun. And you mentioned, you know, about not leaving the medieval behind. From now on, you'll actually see that we see various manifestations of what might be called neo-medievalism. And so we do find that in the light of romanticism, there's a desire, nostalgic desire, for that which predates the Enlightenment and that which predates even the Renaissance, and going back to something which is medieval. And of course, just the fact that Monet is glorying in the beauty of the Gothic here, and allowing the light of the sun, which is, hey, if you like, can be seen as a metaphor for the light of God, to shine on the beauty of this Gothic architecture, I think is something we as Catholics, even though Monet, of course, could not be called a Catholic artist, we as Catholics can be very comfortable in allowing ourselves to be lost in contemplation in looking at this painting.
Yeah, however, though, I would add that it is a very modern portrayal of a medieval building, right? And so it's not a realistic depiction, it is an impression.
Right.
Of this building.
And what Chesterton said, of course, and again, another very good observation, but what Chesterton said of Impressionism in The Man Who Was Thursday is I'll get it right now, that basically it is a philosophy which does not see a bottom to the universe. It lacks definition. So, you know, we talk about realism in terms of just looking at something realistically, but philosophically, the Impressionists, if you like, are forerunners of relativism. Mm-hmm. So just seeing that the various lights of shade, but I would say that, you know, whereas that's true, and absolutely true in the Impressionists, that they replace definition with impression, and that is a sort of relativistic. In this, it is nonetheless the play of light on the lines, mm-hmm. right, of the Gothic, which makes it beautiful. If you remove those lines, you would not have the beauty. So there's a paradox there, which is why I think that this painting, perhaps more than many other Impressionist paintings, is one that Catholics can admire with ease and without too much problem.
Yeah, it's a modern representation of a Gothic masterpiece.
Exactly, exactly.
And I do just have to say personally, I was in Rouen in October, and I saw the full moon just above the spires of this church. Oh. And so I didn't see it in daylight, actually, right. Only in the night, but illuminated by a full moon, it was stunning.
I can only imagine.
Okay, so we're going to continue engaging the Middle Ages and one of your favorite artists with our next painting.
Yes, indeed. So it's a different movement in art now. So we're the Impressionist movement, of course. So I talked about Turner as being a forerunner of the Impressionists, and then, but of course, the Impressionist movement is a French movement. But we're now looking at the Pre-Raphaelites. So for those that have got their fingers ready to do a Google search, we're now looking at Dante Gabriel Rossetti's painting, Beata Beatrice. And so this is Dante Gabriel Rossetti is one of the artists of the Pre-Raphaelite movement, or the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood, as they're often known. And the Pre-Raphaelites, as their name would suggest, were looking for a purer medieval view of things. They sort of leapfrog over the whole Renaissance, the whole period of modern art, Baroque art, and the Renaissance art, to find a purer vision of art, which is pre-Raphael, so early Renaissance and medieval. So here, of course, and appropriately, he is taking as his inspiration Dante's Divine Comedy. So what we see here, the woman in the foreground is Beatrice, and it's the death of Beatrice. And the dove is delivering the roses, which symbolizes the moment of her death. The sundial behind there, of course, is time, the memento mori, the sundial like the hourglass, you know, that the sun's setting on her life. And then to the right at the back there is Dante himself looking on, the top right-hand corner. And then left, I'm taking this to be, from the imagery from the Divine Comedy, Charity, that the woman clothed in red from the earthly paradise at the top of purgatory. So we have God's love, charity, we have Dante, we have time, we have the dove delivering death, if you like, and we have the death of Beatrice. So all of this going on in what I think is a marvelous and certainly one of my all-time favorite paintings, but I'm sure you're going to give some caveats.
No, I would simply say that, you know, why her death, right? And it is her death that enables her to be Dante's muse, right?
Yes.
Because he actually did not know her personally, right? And you see in the background, you know, Ponte Vecchio, the bridge over the river Arno in Florence.
Yes.
And that is where he first saw her, right?
Yeah.
And he had this religious type experience,
yes.
Right? You know, and you know, never even had a conversation with her, although he saw her on a couple of other occasions. She was married to someone else. Dante was married, of course, to someone else. But it is this death that enables her to take on this mystical role in the Divine Comedy.
Yeah, and so she is, of course, his muse in many ways. And I think you can say that a large part of the Divine Comedy is his purging himself of the idolatrous aspects of his relationship with her. Mm-hmm. Because in the end, of course, once we get to the paradise, she points to the saints and to the Blessed Virgin and to God. That, you know, the whole purpose of Dante's love for Beatrice was that through Beatrice and his love for Beatrice, he could come to know the love of God and to the love of the ultimate. In some sense, Beatrice is a Marian figure, but of course the Marian figure ultimately needs to point to Mary, and that's what in the Divine Comedy she does. I would say, you know, there's an element of the decadence in this. It is a modern painting as well as being a neo-medievalist painting. Dante Gabriel Rossetti was a great admirer of the Divine Comedy, but he was not a Catholic. And there's this sort of the paleness of her face, and this is a real model, a woman that the artist knew, and there's something of the modern woman in the look of Beatrice here. She does not actually look like quite Quattrocento beauty, right? she's much more 19th century modern girl. But so if you like that, if you can be seen as something which puts a modern edge on it. But for me, at least, it doesn't actually take away from the beauty of the painting.
Well, just as the first Dante needed to have his love purified, I think the second Dante, you know, the painter as well.
Yes, indeed, exactly. He needs his own Beatrice, right?
Now, you like the Pre-Raphaelites.
I do.
Because, you know, our next selection, which you told me was one of your favorite paintings from this school. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
This might actually be my all-time favorite. And, you know, it's a bit like when people ask me what my favorite Shakespeare play is, you know, it depends on what day of the week. So I might say, oh, it's Hamlet, but then you ask me next week, it's King Lear. But so this might be the same, but certainly this is one that's always up there. So for those that are Googling it, this is Mariana by John Everett Millais, Millais, another Pre-Raphaelite artist. And this is quintessentially medieval in a romantic sense. So again, just to remind ourselves, the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood was one of the neo-medieval manifestations of romanticism. And here we see this idealized view here. And what I love about it, I love the stained glass, I love the use of color, I love the use of shadow. I love the dead leaves that have blown in through the window there. But I think one thing that I really do admire in great artists is the ability they have to make them tactile. The actual fabric of her dress, you can touch the velvet of it, and again also the stole that's behind her, the fabric of that, you can almost feel it as fabric, not as paint. And I think only the greatest artists actually managed to achieve that well, and which is why I think Millais in this painting is definitely one of the greatest artists.
Now, you mentioned, right, this is not a Catholic painter, but it is in a way engaging the Catholic tradition. You have the Annunciation right in front of Mariana here. And then, you know, like our last painting, there's also a literary reference as well. Do you want to explain that a little bit?
Well, it's a Tennyson poem. So again, what the Pre-Raphaelites did, they actually took literature as one. So there's many Arthurian paintings. There's the Lady of Shalott, which was... but that's also Tennyson, I think,
isn't it? Yes.
And then you've got the La Belle Dame sans Merci, which of course a wonderful poem by Keats. So these are all subjects that the Pre-Raphaelites use. Tennyson's poem is also a neo-medieval poem. So it's 19th century nostalgia for Catholic England, ironically, because these paintings and these artists and poets are not actually Catholics themselves.
Now, we only have time for one more painting, and this now brings us into the 20th century, and it's pushing the boundaries right here a bit, you know.
Being a bit risque now.
Right, yeah. Would you like to explain our last painting?
Yes, well, you know, this is controversial. So, for those that want to be looking at it with us, and I hope you're not going to be offended, this poem is called Spain, 1936, and it's by Salvador Dali. Now, you know, years ago, I edited a magazine called the St. Austin Review, and years ago, we had a theme, Modern Art, Friend or Foe. And I had one of Dali's Catholic paintings on the cover. And Dali, to me, is a very controversial figure because he converts to Catholicism, but even then he's a somewhat quirky Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly no one would hold him up as a saint as regards the way that he lived his life. But unlike Picasso, and I might even invite people to compare this painting, Spain 1936, with Picasso's painting Guernica, because they're both about the Spanish Civil War. Whereas Picasso was on the side of the Republicans, on the side of the Communists, Salvador Dali was actually on the side of the Nationalists, on the side of Franco. And that's because he loved Spain, but he also loved Catholic Europe. He loved the Catholic Spain. So this is something which is actually... whereas Guernica is very ugly and talks about the destructiveness of war, and there's no doubt at all that the Spanish Civil War is very ugly, here we see Salvador Dali eulogizing the figure of Spain herself. So we actually see a classical figure suggested by other figures in it. This is the surrealist aspect to it. But there's a real classical side to this surrealism, because this is a classic female figure depicted when you get through the imagery fairly classically and realistically, and very romantically. She's beautiful, right? She's not ugly. This is Spain, and this is something which warrants our love and loyalty, bearing in mind this isn't at the beginning of the Spanish Civil War. It's actually a work of patriotism and Catholicism. Then, although Dali would become more Catholic later, and some of his later paintings are certainly more Catholic than this one, I just like this as just an idealization of Spain during the Civil War. And my sympathies are certainly with the Nationalists and not the Republicans, so there's an element of sympathy on that, should we say, ideological, spiritual level as well. But it is a controversial piece, and I can understand why people might not like it.
So, I mean, you mentioned that there's a surrealist depiction of a woman here. Only her arm, you know, is clearly depicted. Can you describe some of the things that are happening in the painting?
Yeah, well, basically, you know, the rest of her outline is suggested by things happening in the landscape or by figures. So, obviously, we actually have her breasts, to put it mildly, is two people fighting, and this is, of course, the war. Other aspects of her body are delineated by other human figures and by horses, or by suggested undulations in the landscape. So, in other words, she's, in some sense, she's an embodiment of Spain herself, you know. So it's like Britannia, you know, this figure of Britannia, who's an embodiment of Britain. What Dali's doing here is trying to encapsulate Spain by embodying Spain as a woman.
Yes, and you mentioned, you know, just the controversy of modern art, friend or foe. And I know people feel very strongly in both ways, but there are truly artists of genius in the 20th century, and Dali would be one of them. And they can teach us a lot about our own culture. I think our souls are expressed in art, and we see this in these figures, for better and worse. As you mentioned, yeah. Picasso and Dali, you know, both expressing that in different ways.
And, you know, and the point is, a large part of modern art, should we say, deteriorated and decayed into abstract expressionism and various manifestations of nihilism. And Dali went in the opposite direction. And so, you know, the point is that even though he's using surrealism, so the image of dreams, he depicts them very realistically. You know, he uses very much realism, and he's hankering after tradition when everyone else is decaying. So yeah, I would agree with most people, or at least most people that listen to this podcast, that most modern art is actually not very good and not worth our time. But I think Salvador Dali is certainly one of several artists that general rule does not apply to.
Well, I hope we can talk about more of them in the future, and we can continue this conversation about great Catholic art. This conversation actually began because of a page on my website, buildingcatholicculture.com, in which I discuss cultural literacy, and I make some very basic suggestions for exploring Catholic art and our cultural heritage. So, Joseph, I hope we can continue this conversation. It was a pleasure being a guest host, and thank you all for listening.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Faith and Culture with Joseph Pierce. Faith and Culture is a production of the Augustine Institute. For more information, please visit us at faithandculture.com.